Welcome to the South Carolina State Library's podcast, Library Voices SC. I'm Curtis Rogers, Communications Director, and today I'm pleased to have with us in our studio Patricia McNeely. Patricia G. Pat, she goes by Pat, McNeely is Professor Emerita at the University of South Carolina in Columbia, South Carolina, where she taught writing and reporting for 33 years in the School of Journalism. Before joining the faculty, she was a reporter and editor for three South Carolina newspapers, The State, The Columbia Record, and The Greenville News. She is the author of Andrew Jackson, John C. Calhoun, and The Petticoat Affair. She is the author of many other books, including Sherman's Flame and Blame Campaign Through Georgia and the Carolinas and the Burning of Columbia, and Palmetto Press, The History of South Carolina's Newspapers. And I know we've had her here many times at the State Library, so it's great to have you back. So welcome to the podcast.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
So tell us a little bit about this latest book. This is Andrew Jackson, John C. Calhoun, and the Petticoat Affair. Tell us a little bit about the history of the book and Jackson and Calhoun.
I grew up in the upcountry of South Carolina, hearing the gossip and the legends about Andrew Jackson and John C. Calhoun, both sons of South Carolina, and both born during the period when the nation was being founded, and they together were dominant forces leading the country into the first half of the 18th century. The 19th century. When I first started working on this, I actually didn't realize how intertwined their lives were and how much they came to depend on each other and how much each of them affected the other in their political lives and affected our lives, too. Mm-hmm. And our government now is still being affected by these two giants of their times.
Well, it really is amazing because, you know, living here in South Carolina, we hear the names John C. Calhoun and Andrew Jackson all the time. But I think a lot of people don't realize what a national level they played at in politics.
Yes, and the amazing thing was that the political scene during that time, as the two of them ran for president in 1824, and again in 1828, those two elections were so violent and so wild that they really were the most violent elections of our times, including recent times. They were beset with scandals in every direction, and the two of them actually began as political allies, mm-hmm. but ended as enemies as they entered the election of 1828 that finished them off. And it was the Petticoat Affair that really separated these two close political allies.
Well, you know, it's interesting to hear you say that it was, you know, such a treacherous campaign and election, because I think we tend to forget, you know, we tend to only remember the most recent, and to think they didn't even have Twitter back then. You know?
Well, I hate to think what it would have been if they had had Twitter, but it really just was so much worse than anything we have seen in our lifetime that I was stunned to see some of the charges that were made during that election.
What were some? What made it so horrible?
The main thing was that Andrew Jackson had decided that the election of 1824 had been stolen. Mm. And it's a long story, but in a way it was, because he did win the plurality of the electoral vote and also the plurality of the popular vote. But nevertheless, he didn't win. And when it was thrown into the House of Representatives, there was a time there when Henry Clay, Speaker of the House, made a deal with John Quincy Adams, mm-hmm. and that cost Andrew Jackson the election of 1824, and the election of 1828 began right then. It was violent, each one accusing the other of really awful things. Some of the things that Andrew Jackson was accused of was murder. He was accused of having lived with his wife before she was divorced, and it was true. That really was true, and he was accused of a variety of other things. And they even came up with what they call the coffin bills, that were charges against Andrew Jackson, accusing him of killing all kinds of people. And he was involved in duels and did kill a lot of people. And the Jackson men retaliated by accusing John Quincy Adams' men of that John Quincy Adams had been a pimp for the Russian czar.
Oh, my goodness.
And that the reason he was so good with all of his negotiations with international countries was because he was pimping for the governments. And so there were terrible things.
So the more things change, the more they stay the same.
I couldn't believe when I saw this. It was just like deja vu.
All over again.
That's funny.
So you mentioned that Andrew Jackson and John C. Calhoun were friends. Were they friends growing up, or were they about the same age? What was their history like, or did they just maybe become friends initially during their forays into politics?
They were actually 15 years apart, but they were enough alike to be brothers, and they became close friends and political allies during the War of 1812, because by that time, John C. Calhoun was the Secretary of War, and of course, Andrew Jackson saved the nation's honor, not the war itself, but saved the nation's honor when he won at the Battle of New Orleans, and he became the national hero. Together, they became political friends and allies, and both were running for president in 1824. But John C. Calhoun, when John C. Calhoun saw how popular Andrew Jackson had become, he stepped back and ran for vice president instead. But always after that, they were such good friends and close allies that it was a foregone conclusion that Andrew Jackson would support John C. Calhoun for president after he decided not to run again.
Interesting. And the fascinating thing, I've only read a little bit so far, but when we start talking about the petticoat affair, and in comes the name Peggy Eaton, how does all that come about? Because it's really fascinating just to find out some of the tidbits.
After Andrew Jackson was elected president in 1828, he appointed his best friend and senator from Tennessee, John Eaton, Secretary of War, and at that time, both of them had been staying, both Andrew Jackson and John Eaton had, when they came to Washington as senators from Tennessee, had stayed at the O'Neill boarding house. And there was a daughter there, Peggy O'Neill, who was actually married during the time that Jackson and Eaton knew her. But her husband had died at sea 4 months before Jackson was elected. And Eaton married her. During that time, it was very bad and impolite, and the custom then that no woman would remarry within a year after she had been widowed. Along with that, she had something of a reputation of being a flirt, because she had grown up in her father's tavern, and she could speak, she could talk politics with anybody. She was quite beautiful. She must have been Hollywood beautiful, because
and you can tell, because even looking at the cover of the book, you've got a picture of her, and she really was
gorgeous. She was absolutely gorgeous. But at any rate, Eaton married her right on January 1st, 1829, as the Jackson administration went in. Well, the wives of Washington were appalled, because it was the custom during that time for the women to call on each other and leave calling cards. And one woman had written, one of the socialites had written, "Oh my, I have so much to do. I have to call on 50 people this month." The other one said, "Oh my dear, that's nothing. I have 500. So it was quite the custom to call on each other, and you had to do it. So when Peggy Eaton became the wife of the cabinet member, she was supposed to be part of that social circle. but the Washington wives refused to call on her, turned their backs on her, and even John C. Calhoun's wife refused to call on her. And so Andrew Jackson was so certain that she was a woman of virtue and character, mm-hmm. that he called a cabinet meeting and ordered his cabinet members to have their wives socialize with Peggy Eaton, and they all refused. This went on for a year and a half of his administration, and he devoted 75 letters that you'll find in the Library of Congress defending her honor. But after something like 2.5 years of constantly trying to make them socialize with her, he finally gave up and fired his entire cabinet because of her. And still nobody would socialize with her.
That's amazing. And all because of her background?
Or? Her background, and because she had married within four months after she had been widowed. But she was a tavern keeper's daughter, and she was not worthy of being a socialite, they thought.
Well, what were the politics like at this time? What were the political parties at this time?
Well, in the election of 1828, there was only one party. All the people running in 1824 were all in the same party. They were all Democratic Republicans, all of them. And so it was not until the election of 1828 that we established the two-party system as we know it today. And it was during that time, of course, that the Democratic Party, as we know it today, was established as people who were supporting Andrew Jackson. But up until that time, we really didn't have but one party during that time. But they still believed in different ideologies in spite of the fact that they were all in the same party. Mm-hmm. But the main bone of contention during all of this was the tariff. And, you know, you could pick up a newspaper today, and you could read what's going on about the tariffs, and you could change the names of the people involved, and this would be the same argument that was going on in 1828, because during that time, the Tariff of Abominations was passed, and it was a period when the tariff, which had started in 1789, it was the only way they could raise money, actually, for the government. But the tariff had started as a way to support the government, but it had quickly become a way to build up the factories in the north, because England had not allowed us to have any. And the bottom line on all of that was that the southern states were paying the most in taxes because of the tariff that was imposed at that time. The Tariff of Abominations was a tariff that imposed 62% tariff on manufactured cloth coming back from England. And it was doing it for all practical purposes, that was destroying the South. The South was paying literally 2/3 of the federal revenue with only half of the population. And that's why John C. Calhoun went into a rage and tried to have that tariff nullified. He was hoping that when Jackson was elected that he would do something about it. But Jackson had also discovered that the only way he could get elected was by bringing in the big states like New York and Pennsylvania. And that's where the manufacturing was being supported. The protective tariff was protecting them. And that was what he had to have to win the election. So he actually supported the tariff. And so it was a terrible situation, and the tariff of abominations of 1828 led to a call up of troops in South Carolina in 1833. And during that time, we were trying to nullify this tariff of 62% on the cotton cloth that was actually destroying the trade. It was a trade war, and it was destroying the businesses, the cotton business in South Carolina. And so it was put down by Jackson, though, when he put in the force bill, saying that he had the right to send troops to South Carolina to forcefully collect the taxes. Hmm. And so there was a compromise put in place, but it wasn't enough of a compromise. And by 1842, the tariff had gone back up again, so that it was a killing tariff and would eventually be one of the major factors leading to the Civil War.
That is amazing, because when you start thinking about the time frames of, you know, in the 1820s, 1828, 1833, 1840s, and then leading up to the Civil War, that was a, you know, it wasn't just a geyser, it was a Mount Vesuvius, because all that pressure had been building up over all of these kinds of things going on, and then I guess they finally got to that breaking point.
It was, and the amazing thing about it is that everybody thinks of John C. Calhoun as being the father of nullification in an effort to nullify a federal law. Mm-hmm. But actually, Thomas Jefferson was the father of nullification, and he was the one who believed that a state had the right to nullify an unconstitutional law. Mm-hmm. And so in many ways, John C. Calhoun was the last of the founding fathers, because he, like Thomas Jefferson, really believed that the United States was a confederation of states, and that they all should respect each other, and that they should not have unconstitutional laws that would be punitive to one or more of the states. Mm-hmm. But the majority was in the North by that time, and they had found that by voting in these tariffs, they could, for all practical purposes, avoid paying most of the taxes and have the southern states pay most of the federal revenue. Hmm. So that was what was happening as far as the political situation.
Right.
It was really growing and festering, so that by time both Thomas Jefferson, by the time John C. Calhoun and Andrew Jackson died, this had grown to such a force that John C. Calhoun predicted when he died that there would be some major catastrophe and eruption within 12 years after his death. Mm. And he predicted it would be during a presidential election.
Goodness.
And he was right.
That's amazing. Back to the Petticoat Affair. How did it get that name? What's the history behind just the phrase Petticoat Affair?
Well, the wives of Washington were the ones who were refusing to have anything to do with Peggy Eaton. Mm-hmm. And so by the time it hit the newspapers, and it did hit the newspapers finally, the newspapers started calling it the Petticoat Affair, because it was the women of Washington.
Okay.
They also called it the Petticoat War. Uh-huh. And amazingly, even though almost nobody knows who Peggy Eaton is today, she became such a nationally known figure that newspapers would put entire pages showing pictures of her with her long ringlets of hair, and it was called the Peggy O'Neill curl, and they had pictures of this, and it became a rage that people would wear their hair with this. It looks like Scarlett O'Hara.
It does.
Sort
it
of
really
the
does.
Ringlets.
I'm looking at the cover of the book, and you can really, really tell.
And the amazing thing is that newspapers all over the country were writing full page page stories about her. Mm-hmm. And in 1931, a movie was made about her called The Gorgeous Hussy, starring Joan Crawford. And it was her Joan Crawford's highest grossing movie ever.
Wow.
And it also starred Robert Young as her first husband, and also a miscast Lionel Barrymore as Andrew Jackson in this movie.
Wow.
But that movie's still available. I've got it. I bought it.
Great.
And looked at it. It's not very detailed, and it's just mostly around the fringes of the scandal. But nevertheless, it was an interesting thing that it was interesting enough to be a movie by that time.
Definitely. So that makes a good companion to your book.
Yeah, it does. It does. And actually, interestingly, on YouTube these days, you can find little snippets of that movie. And you can also find, I was really surprised to see that some recent students have been putting together, I saw a monologue put together about Peggy Eaton, and and John C. Calhoun's wife, mm-hmm. and that's on YouTube. And so some students today and mm-hmm. some other people have been getting together and remembering Peggy Eaton. So it's amazing that she's still remembered by some, but we still don't know who she was.
Isn't that amazing? How did you first get interested in the Petticoat Affair itself? Had you always known about it, or was it something that came to you quite recently?
I had never heard of the Petticoat Affair, and I started out writing about John C. Calhoun, and then I began to realize how much the lives of John C. Calhoun and Andrew Jackson were involved with each other. Mm-hmm. They were so intertwined that they did together become the dominant forces of the early 19th century. In fact, that whole half of the between 1800 and 1850, when John C. Calhoun died, the two of them together dominated American politics. So I started out writing about that because I grew up hearing all these rumors and stories about them, and then I stumbled upon the Peggy Eaton scandal that was part of their lives. And so it's a sort of a misnomer to call it a scandal, because by today's standards, she really was only considered to be disreputable in the eyes of the Washington socialites. Mm-hmm, and so by today's standards, this was nothing.
Right. It goes to show you how societal norms can dramatically change over centuries.
And yet this affair, as they called it, made Andrew Jackson create what was called the first kitchen cabinet. Everybody thinks that Franklin Delano Roosevelt had the first kitchen cabinet. But Andrew Jackson was so outraged by his cabinet while he was trying to get them to socialize with Peggy Eaton that he finally decided to have nothing to do with them in that period of 2.5 years when he was struggling to get people to socialize with her. And he created a kitchen cabinet. And these were close advisors who came in the back door and came in the kitchen and came in at night, came in all kinds of days, day at night. And he only occasionally called his official cabinet together. And they called the official cabinet the parlor cabinet.
Okay.
And the others who came in, the kitchen cabinet.
That's interesting.
And then in 1832, when he'd finally had enough of them not socializing, he just fired them all.
Wow. That's all because of Peggy.
All because of Peggy.
One of the things that I wanted to mention, especially for folks who are listening and they don't have a copy of your book in front of them, is that you have a lot of images in here, and a lot of them are, you know, sourced from the Library of Congress. And did you also get anything from the South Carolina Library, or because a lot of times you can find things there too?
I do have several in there, and I love the Carolina Library, and frequently send over notes asking if they have images of certain things, and they are very good and very kind to me, and I do have some in there. I do have a lot in there from the Library of Congress, because the Library of Congress is just a fabulous source for me. And anytime I'm looking for something, when I'm writing about somebody, I start looking to see what kinds of images are available both at the Library of Congress and also at Carolinianna. And I'm always stunned because I want to see how these people look.
Right.
And it's amazing how much is actually there. And I love to put all these pictures in so that everybody can see what these people looked like and see the documents. And there are even images there from Harper's Weekly showing Andrew Jackson firing his cabinet. And there's an image of him sitting in a big chair and all of his cabinet members are like little mice running around at his feet, and he's getting rid of all of the rats in his cabinet.
That's
it's
amazing.
Just amazing.
And you also went around taking photos of places.
I did. The other thing that I have to do when I'm working on anything, I have to go to the places where these happen as much as I can. So I actually visited the Hermitage. I went to Tennessee and to Nashville to visit the Hermitage and spent a whole day there going through the images that they had, going through the museum there, And then I went to, of course, to Clemson I had been many times to what we call the Calhoun Mansion. Mm-hmm. There is called Fort Hill officially, but I had been many times when I was growing up to Calhoun Mansion, so I was very familiar with that. And so I had a lot of documents on all of that, and I take my own pictures. And then I went up to the Andrew Jackson State Park, mm-hmm. and took a lot of pictures there. And the other interesting thing is that North Carolina claims that Andrew Jackson was born there, but you can pretty clearly establish that he was actually born in South Carolina, because Andrew Jackson himself said four different times that he was born on the Crawford Plantation, which is what the Andrew Jackson State Park is in Lancaster County.
Okay.
And there's a monument there showing that this is where the Crawford Plantation was, and this is where Andrew Jackson said he was born. He said it four different times. And so there's even a delayed birth certificate now for Andrew Jackson that's
really?
Been put through in
wow.
the state archives. They have it over there at the state archives. So anyway, I want to go to these places. I want to feel what was going on during those times. So I try to go to as many places as I can and take my own pictures.
Yeah, definitely. It puts you right in touch with what it is you're describing. So we've mentioned the State Archives and Carolinianna Library. And what other roles or other libraries have you used to do some of your research?
I have to also mention the Richland County Library and Debbie Bloom, who is in charge of the local history room there. She is I almost consider her my assistant, because when I run into a little brick wall with something that I can't find, I have even emailed her in the middle of the night, Debbie, this is a magazine article. I've got to have it, but it was in a magazine that was published in 1860, and this is the title of it, and this is what it is, but I can't get to it. Mm-hmm. And the next morning,
there it is.
Debbie is so good. And she's
in fact, we just had Debbie on a podcast talking about South Carolina genealogy and electronic resources in genealogy. So she's a great resource.
She is. Yeah. She absolutely is. So I always have a lot of help, but the library resources are so important to me, because I can't write these books without the library resources that are available to me now.
Well, you know, working in a library, I love to hear that. That's great. So what kind of other special projects are you going to be working on in the coming months? Because it seems like you've always got some new interesting tidbit of history that you want to get out there.
Well, I always have a lot of things that I'm working on. And the problem was, when I was teaching journalism at the University of South Carolina, my research focus was journalism history, but I didn't have time to write any many books. I just wrote two while I was there. But I had a lot of other research. And so after I retired, I had lots and lots of research that I could see would, if I could just develop those, would be great books, because this Petticoat Affair, for example, is the two together, Andrew Jackson and John C. Calhoun and the Petticoat Affair, has not really been written by anybody. Mm-hmm. So I have a lot of research that I still have. Mm-hmm. And right now, my next books, I have three that I'm working on diligently right now. But I don't know which one I'm going to finish first. And I also have some other research that I have that I also need to complete. So the answer is, I'm working on something, but in the meantime, I don't know which one is going to be finished first. And most of all, I am so happy that so many people have been inviting me to come and speak about not only the Petticoat Affair, which is the one I'll be I'm speaking on most frequently today, but also the earlier books that I have written. And so last year alone, for example, I figured that I had made 52 presentation book signings around the state, and I also taught some Civil War classes at local Shepherd centers.
Okay.
And I will be teaching a class on the Petticoat Affair again soon at one of the Shepherd centers in Columbia.
Well, it sounds like you're busier now than you were when you were teaching.
Yes, I need to go back to work to rest up.
So you can have
to
a
rest
vacation.
Up. I need a vacation.
Exactly. Well, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you for inviting me.
And thank you for your enthusiasm. It's really exciting to learn about this stuff. And also thank you to our listeners. You can find Library Voices SC on Podbean, Stitcher, and TuneIn Radio, or add us on your favorite podcast app. Our podcast website address is librarycast.podbean.com. We love hearing from our listeners, so send us your comments and suggestions for future topics. Library Voices SC is the official podcast of the South Carolina State Library. Until next time, this is Curtis Rogers. Thanks for listening.